Hello, my name's Dave Emery. This is side two of For the Record program number 312, being recorded on July 15th of the year 2001. Once again, it's my pleasure to present Kevin Coogan, the brilliant author of the vitally important recent book, Dreamer of the Day, Francis Parker Yockey and the Postwar Fascist International, published in softcover by Otano Media, copyright 1999. Kevin, welcome back once again to our airwaves.
Thanks for having me.
In discussing Willis Carto, and we're going to get back to Carto because we have digressed in the first side of this discussion, we have digressed from Carto to some of the other elements of the landscape of which he's an integral part. Another person who has been very influential on the far right and in circles that some might call fascist is a fellow named Professor Revelo Oliver. I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about Oliver and how he connects with the milieu of Carto.
Well, Revelo P. Oliver first came into prominence in the far right in the late 1950s because he had actually written a few articles for National Review. Some background of Oliver. Oliver was, I believe he was born in Texas, but he was a professor of classics at, I think maybe Northern Illinois University. I'm not quite sure exactly. But he had tenure, and he was an expert really on Sanskrit. And he was sort of famous for knowing an amazing number of ornate words, which naturally made him very attractive to Buckley. So he began writing a few columns, of book reviews for National Review. And Robert Welsh, who was the founder of the John Birch Society, was intrigued and impressed by Oliver. So when Welsh was forming the Birch Society, he sent out his copies of his book. He wrote a book which was purporting to show that Eisenhower was part of the communist conspiracy. And one of the people he sent it to was Oliver, and then he invited Oliver to the founding council of the John Birch Society, which Oliver attended. And so for about 5 or 6 years, Oliver was a very important figure inside the Birch Society. He even, oddly enough, has a connection to the Kennedy assassination, because after the assassination, Oliver wrote a two-part article in the Birch Journal called, I think, Marksmanship in Dallas, which tried to blame the Oswald shooting of Kennedy on a Marxist-communist conspiracy.
Mm-hmm. And fact, that, by the way, is one of the major elements of what Professor Peter Dale Scott has called the first-level cover-up, which is to blame it on the commies and then to try to get the liberals to cover it up because they're afraid to be a Third World War.
Right, right. And Oliver, and the thing about Oliver's connections is that he was invited to testify before the Warren Commission, and in part because he had a lot of friends inside Congress who were very interested in the Birch Society. I mean, recall this is at a time when Goldwater had become the Republican candidate for president. So there was a lot of this sort of far right beliefs floating around. But Oliver ran into trouble inside the Birch Society because by the mid-1960s, he began getting on the Jewish conspiracy kick in a major, major way. And Welsh, for all his problems, never really embraced the idea of a Jewish conspiracy. I mean, Welsh had the idea that the Illuminati was out to take over the world, but the Illuminati was not, in Welsh's mind, a code word for the Jews. It was simply the Illuminati. So Oliver was forced out of the John Birch Society in the mid-60s. Now, around the same time, Carto was himself trying to use the ferment around the far right, which had been generated by the George Wallace movement, to set up a new organization in Washington. And in 1968, after Wallace had lost the bid for presidency, there was a group called Youth for Wallace, which was the, just as it sounds, the youth wing of the George Wallace movement. Carto moved in to essentially take over the Youth for Wallace and change it to a new organization called, I think, the National Youth Alliance, the NYA. Now, working with Carto in this operation was Revelo P. Oliver, who from the Birch Society, after being exiled from the Birch Society, became a buddy of Carto's. Now, the third person to get involved with this milieu was none other than William Pierce, who today is the head of the National Alliance. And in fact, the National Alliance derives its name from the National Youth Alliance that Quarto, Pierce, and Oliver had set up in the 68-69.
And by the way, I would add parenthetically, the National Vanguard Books, its publishing arm, is not only the publisher of the relatively well-known Turner Diaries, but also of the book Serpent's Walk that veteran listeners have heard me talk about many times. Go ahead, Kevin.
Well, now Pierce himself was also in exile from the American Nazi Party, because when George Lincoln Rockwell was assassinated, the American Nazi Party, which I think it changed its name to the National Socialist White People's Party,
mm-hmm.
had been taken over by a guy named Matt Cale. Now, curiously enough, since we mentioned the National Renaissance Party, Matt Cale himself had been for many years a member of the National Renaissance Party, really dating back to the 1950s.
Now, the spelling on that, excuse me for interrupting, Kevin, is K-O-E-H-L, is it not?
Yes.
Okay, good, because
yep.
if people are listening and they may be looking for a C-A-L-E, but his last name is K-O-E-H-L. Go ahead.
Yes, yeah. And so what happened is that in the power struggle for control over the Nazi Party, he won and Pierce lost. So Quarto, knowing that Pierce had been in exile from Rockwell's party, and that Oliver had been kicked out of the John Birch Society, he formed an alliance with them to launch his own group called this National Youth Alliance, off of the group of the Wallace campaign, the Youth Movement of the Wallace campaign, and so they created the NYA. Now, very interestingly, what happened is that very soon there was a major conflict between the NYA and William F. Buckley, because Buckley, Robert Welch, never jumped on the anti-Semitic bandwagon the way that Quarto and Oliver did, and so there was a tremendous amount of tension inside the far right between Buckley and Quarto over the NYA. And actually, one of the best initial articles on Yaki and Quarto in this whole milieu was published in the National Review, I think, in 1971.
In fact, I was involved in an exchange of letters with a fellow from the Liberty Lobby, Michael Collins Piper, in fact, in a conspiracy publication, because I characterized the Liberty Lobby as fascist, and he took issue with my characterization, said it was populist, not fascist. But
right.
in providing documentation, I even cited Buckley in the National Review. Certainly not anybody, not an element that people are going to mistake for liberals, as citing the Liberty Lobby as fascist and explicitly anti-Semitic.
Right. Well, this goes back to what we were talking about earlier, about how much, when you look at many of these milieus, there are so many fights and feuds and factions within groups that people from the outside sort of tend to lump together as being on the far right. But the closer you look, the more complicated it gets, because there's so much kind of micro-political feuding and arguing, and also there are arguments over real ideas and real principled positions on all sides. So getting back to Yaki and Quarto, what Quarto had wanted to do with the National Youth Alliance was to really promote Imperium. And in fact, Quarto put out a paperback edition of Imperium, which was kind of to be the little red book of the National Youth Alliance. And he tried to develop the National Youth Alliance into an organization that was really run by people who embraced the ideas of Imperium and Yaki. But what happened is that the older element that had been identified with George Wallace, the actual organizers of the Youth for Wallace, many of them were much closer to the viewpoint of a person like Buckley than they were of Quarto. And so there was a really bitter split inside the NYA. And as a result, by 69 and 70, really the NYA became a kind of a front group for Quarto, which Quarto ran out of Washington. No, in other words, no longer had the possibility of being kind of like a mass-based political party. But out of that group, this is where Quarto himself then tried to approach the far left, because it was during this time that Quarto began organizing these tribunals to accuse the Eastern establishment and the Council for Foreign Relations of war crimes. And not surprisingly, one of the leading war criminals was William F. Buckley.
That is certainly that's the first time I've ever heard William F. Buckley characterized as a war criminal.
Right.
I've heard him characterized in a lot of ways, most of which I couldn't discuss on the air due to FCC regs. But he certainly does have a nice vocabulary. I'll say that from the man.
Right.
One of the individuals that you mentioned as a prime exponent of Yaakiism within the Liberty Lobby is a fellow named Keith Stimley, an individual that I had never heard of before reading your book, Kevin. And Stimley is an individual who touches on a lot of different bases. He is now deceased, is he not?
Yes, that's right. He died of AIDS, I think, in like 1992.
Can you tell us about Keith Stimley, who he is, what is his connection to Carto and the Liberty Lobby, and what is his connection to Yaakiism?
Well, the story of Keith Stimley is a really strange story. Keith Stimley was a guy who, really from childhood, had really been fascinated by the image of Nazism that he had seen on, you know, in movies and TV and things like that. And when he was 15, he came across an article in True Magazine, which is kind of like a men's magazine, a kind of men's adventure magazine, which had an expose on Carto and the Liberty Lobby and this mysterious guy, Francis Parker Yaakie. And Stimley read it and became so fascinated by the story that he decided he'd have to know more about Carto and Yaakie and the Liberty Lobby. So when he was on a high school field trip to D.C., he stopped off and visited the offices of the Liberty Lobby and bought his first copy of Imperium. Then later on, Stimley decided he was so captivated by the sort of Yaakie and Carto and Imperium that he decided he'd actually go to work for the Liberty Lobby. And when Carto set up the Institute for Historical Review in California, Stimley volunteered to work for it and became at one point, I believe, the editor of the Journal for Historical Review, which is the publication of the Institute for Historical Review. This was at a time when the IHR itself was going through numerous fights because the official director of the IHR, a British far-right guy named David McColden, who with Carto had sort of organized the IHR, he and Carto had a big falling out, and after McColden was really kicked out of the IHR, Stimley took over. Now, the way I came across Stimley is that at that time, when Stimley was working at the IHR, a letter came to the IHR from a guy named John Anthony Gannon in England, and Gannon was saying, "Are you going to do anything about Yaakie?" And it turned out that Gannon was one of the original founders of the European Liberation Front. In fact, Gannon met Yaakie in 1948.
Now, is this letter actually mailed to the Journal for Historical Review?
Yes.
Okay,
yes.
So, and that, yes, again, is the publication for the Institute for Historical Review, and best known for Holocaust Denial, and Stimley was its editor for a time.
That's right.
Go ahead.
That's right. And so Gannon was saying, you know, "I knew Yaakie, and I want to see if you're going to reprint anything about Yaakie or about the European Liberation Front." So Stimley, who was already fascinated by Yaakie, began writing back to Gannon, and Gannon, in turn, really wrote a kind of a memoir about his experiences with Yaakie. Gannon also put Stimley in contact with a woman named Elsa DeVette, who had been Yaakie's mistress in the late 1940s. And so really through the IHR connection, Stimley began himself networking into the old wing of people who still remembered Yaakie. And one of these people, the other person who was actually also rather important for my book as well, is a fellow named H. Keith Thompson. Thompson had been a friend of Yaakie's in the 1950s when Yaakie was in New York. And basically, Thompson, this fellow Fred Weiss, who was a German national who had been living in the United States since the 1930s, and Yaakie kind of formed Yaakie's, they were the people who really promoted Yaakie and Yaakie-ism in the United States along with Carto. So what happened is that Thompson himself, through Stimley, Thompson began speaking at conferences of the IHR. Now, Thompson in the 1950s was very much involved in organizing the support for Admiral Dönitz, who had been the head of the German submarine force during World War II, who after the war had been put in jail as a war criminal. And Thompson was very much involved in lobbying the people in the United States and in Europe to help Dönitz be released from prison, and not serve his full sentence.
And by the way, in past discussions of H. Keith Thompson, we've discussed the fact that he was an activist on behalf of the Third Reich and possibly an agent of the Sicherheitsdienst before, during, and after World War II, and also a close associate of Yaki's. Go ahead, Kevin.
Yes, and just as another footnote to that, he was also very close to this man named George Sylvester Viereck, which your listeners may have heard of, because Viereck was, in World War II, actually put in jail for being a Nazi agent, a Nazi propaganda agent. So Thompson had all these connections. And in fact, Thompson, when we were speaking of the defenders of the American Constitution, Thompson was also involved with that milieu, because many of the people were former military men and former admirals, and they were themselves willing to supply recommendations to say that, yes, Admiral Dönitz is a hero and should not have been convicted for war crimes.
And
so,
by the way, in past discussions of Stimley, also, not Stimley, but of H. Keith Thompson, we've also mentioned that he, by his own account, was served as the press agent for Margarita Oswald, Lee Harvey Oswald's mother, and was involved with weapons trafficking, allegedly, through some of these post-World War II Odessa connections to both Batista and Castro in Cuba. That we discussed that in one of our latter discussions. So this is an individual who laps on many, many shores.
Yeah, he's an amazing character. I mean, at the very least, that's what you can say.
And again, for people who might be inclined to oversimplify the landscape of international fascism, it is anything but simple, and there are very, very sharp divisions which would defy ideologization. Go ahead, Kevin.
So what happened is that Stimley began also setting up a correspondence with H. Keith Thompson, and really through Stimley, Thompson's book, Dönitz at Nuremberg, which Thompson had put together in the 1950s, was reprinted as a book, which is you can currently buy through Noontide Press. So there, through Stimley's connections to the IHR and to Cardo, Stimley developed a kind of a research program to find out more about Yaki. And I found, quite frankly, that Stimley's archives, when I was doing my book, were very, very helpful. Because when Stimley died, Stimley had never written even a page of his proposed essay on Yaki, but Stimley had given a lot of his material to different archives, including one archive at Hoover, and through various means of just collecting the stuff, I got really invaluable information from Stimley's archive, which I used in my book. So Stimley, for my purposes, for studying Yaki, was really an invaluable source.
Stimley, also an individual whose activities during the course of his lifetime lapped on many shores. Veteran listeners may recall some discussion of Stimley in For the Record program number 211 about fascism and the black metal milieu. Stimley was part of an industrial music coalition called the Abraxas Foundation, which also embraced a guy named Michael Moynihan, who is a fascist musician, a guy named Boyd Rice, of similar disposition, and also publishing guru Adam Parfrey. The only other discussion that I recall offhand of Keith Stimley in these archives.
Well, this is a really complicated story. I mean, in trying to sort of put it all together, this is the best that I could come up with. Stimley, like so many people who have dealings with Willis Cardo, got into an argument with Cardo. And in like 85, 86, I believe that either Stimley quit the IHR or Cardo fired Stimley from the IHR. Stimley then went off on his own and decided to become a kind of a one-man band for the ideas of Yaki and Yakiism.
Mm-hmm.
And he tried to network into various elements in the far right to try and promote Yaki. But because Stimley understood that Yaki himself was not a conventional far rightist, a lot of the people that he thought would be sympathetic to Yaki, he realized they were actually very hostile to Yaki because they didn't share Yaki's, you know, kind of unique version of questions of kind of race and geopolitics that Stimley himself had sort of had himself become more aware of. So Stimley was looking around to see what groups or individuals would support him in his attempt to sort of promote Yakiism in the United States. And through this kind of weird, complicated way, he came across a group called the Abraxas Foundation, which had been established by a man named Boyd Rice, who was a kind of a well-known industrial music musician, but also a member of the Church of Satan. He was a kind of a high priest of the Church of Satan. He's a member of the Council of Nine, of the Church of Satan under this fellow Anton LaVey.
Mm-hmm.
And LaVey, for years, had always flirted with the with Nazis. And in fact, you even go back so far to the 1960s when LaVey was in correspondence with none other than James Madole, who was the leader of the National Renaissance Party.
Mm-hmm.
So you got a kind of like a weird Yaqui connection, not just through Steinle and Thompson, but also through Madole, because Madole was himself very much interested in the occult and liked a lot of what the Church of Satan was saying. So these are relationships that are so bizarre, you know, to the outside world. But nonetheless, these things actually did occur.
And even within the Church of Satan, there are elements of it that are sort of weird libertarians, and other elements such as Boyd Rice, who maintain a doctrinaire orientation to fascism.
That's an extremely important point, because even within, you think that even within tiny groups of just a handful of individuals, they could at least agree with each other. But in fact, inside groups like the Church of Satan, there are splits. There are people who are attracted to a kind of a libertarian, you know, party on mentality. And people like Rice, who became fascinated by this idea that the Nazis were involved with the occult and with the Annan Araba and all this sort of spooky stuff, and who himself projected his own right-wing politics onto the Church of Satan.
One wants to, excuse me for interjecting briefly, Kevin, one wants to avoid oversimplification on some of this, and being something of an old fogey at this point, I know... The popularity of, quote, Satanism, unquote, in certain elements of the youth culture caught me by surprise and struck me as distasteful. And one of the things that I've come to understand is that for some elements of the people that are attracted to that, they see Satanism or that kind of thing as a sort of counterculture protest against right-wing Christianity. And in turn, those young people who might hear this and find that attractive should be aware that within that counterculture, there are elements who make right-wing Christians look relatively liberal by comparison. So that's a caveat. Go ahead, Kevin.
Well, there are definitely debates inside the satanic community and inside the pagan community about all these issues. I mean, the occult world is itself not free of political divisions, and one has to kind of be aware of that and not simply sort of stereotype everybody in one, you know, all pagans are goodies or all pagans are baddies. I mean,
right.
it's a very complicated milieu. But Steinle, I mean, Steinle's interest is that Steinle, who, as far as I can tell, was not a pagan, and as far as music goes, Steinle was actually a classical musician. Steinle played the piano, and some of his letters that you come across, he's always making references to various pieces of classical music that he's now, you know, playing or practicing.
Yaqui was similarly a college.
Yes, exactly. Yaqui was a concert-level classical musician, and Steinle, part of Steinle's obsession with Yaqui is that he felt that they shared some kind of spiritual link through their fascination with classical music and piano in particular. So Steinle was almost the opposite of what we would think of as a kind of a heavy metal, black metal type musician. He was really a classically trained piano player.
Kevin, we were talking, and this is something of a jump, because we've got maybe 5 or 6 minutes
sure.
left before the end of the broadcast, but the foreword to your book was written by Nicholas Goodrick Clark, the author of, among other titles, The Occult Roots of Nazism, and a book that I dealt with at considerable length and, for the record, 172, Hitler's Priestess, Savitri Devi, The Hindu-Aryan Myth, and Neo-Nazism. In the first side of this discussion, we were talking about one of the ideological and perhaps philosophical differences within the SS, and that is the division between what one might call the Waffen-SS and Black or Nordic SS, and you not only characterize that division, but also associate that division to a similar ideological and or philosophical split within the Northern League, and that might be called the division between the Nordic SS and what is characterized as an Indo-European orientation
right.
to that. I wonder, and perhaps this is too tall an order for the last 5 minutes or so, but I wonder if you could perhaps characterize that division and perhaps some of the philosophical underpinnings of that, because that in turn is something that some young people might encounter within the sort of pagan countercultural milieu.
Well, in some ways, it's actually very easy to understand if you think about World War II. And basically, when the World War II broke out and the Germans occupied Northern Europe, Greece, et cetera, the the real question was, well, you know, who were the Germans? Were the Nazi occupiers people who believed that, say, the French were biologically inferior or the Greeks were biologically inferior and really should be treated as a kind of slave labor in a certain sense for the Reich? Or should these people be seen as part of a broader, for lack of a better word, you know, Indo-European group that, in fact, could form a sort of a federation with, of course, Nazi Germany at the center? And so within the SS, there were people who very much for practical reasons were saying the way to occupy Europe, it would be a much better way to occupy Europe if we play down a lot of the Nazi racial superiority stuff and play up the idea of a common cultural heritage of Europe. And this became particularly important when Germany began losing badly the war in the Eastern Front, because that suddenly the SS realized, hey, you know, we need people to fight with us. And the SS tried to, and in fact did recruit volunteers in the Waffen-SS from people in France, in the Netherlands, in Belgium, a very famous Belgium, in fact, a guy named Leon de Grel. Became a kind of a famous figure in the war in the Eastern Front.
A close associate of Otto Skorzeny in the Odessa Milieu.
That's right,
in
the after
post-war
the war.
Period.
That's right, after the war. And you also have to remember that, you know, the Germans themselves were allied with the Italians, who were not Nordics. They were allied with the Romanians, who supplied troops. They were certainly in friendship with Spain, which, while not technically allied, I mean, there were Spanish volunteers fighting in Russia as well. So the elements that had this more pan-European point of view, by the 1943, 1944, they began to gain more credibility simply because the Germans needed bodies. And in fact, you'd even see this in Russia as well. For example, when the Germans invaded Russia, the line to the Russians that was adopted was really almost an exterminationist line, where, you know, Russian culture was considered utterly inferior. The Germans were not interested in, say, promoting, you know, Ukrainian nationalism or any form of alleviation or coalition with the people that they'd occupied. And this was particularly amazing given the fact that so many people who had been so oppressed by Stalin and Stalinism initially welcomed the Germans, thinking this will be just like World War One when the Germans occupied Russia in World War One, but actually helped encourage the formation of independent governments in the Ukraine and other places. But the fact is, under Himmler and Bormann, the Nazis did not follow that policy. They adopted this, you know, utterly, you know, horrendous extermination policy to the Russians as well to everybody else. But when they began losing the war, and they still began encountering Russians who, despite all this, were still willing to fight against Stalin, primarily a guy named General Vlasov, who had been a Soviet military general who actually went over to the Germans after he was captured during the defense of Moscow. All of a sudden, the Germans realized that they had, you know, again, potential volunteers who were not of the correct bloodline. And so, for many different reasons, the idea of the Waffen-SS ideology began growing inside the Third Reich. But I have to say the primary reason was the fact that the Russians were kicking the ass of the Germans, you know, by 1943, after the Russian defense of Stalingrad. Now, what this meant for our purposes is that after the war, inside the far right, some of these lessons were still remembered. Inside the SS, this whole affair simply was not forgotten. And there were elements inside the sort of the post-war Nazi International that argued that what if Germany had taken this more culturally liberal, more open Indo-European, as you put it, view of the people that Germany had occupied, if Germany had in fact done that, it's quite possible Germany could have won World War II, versus the people who were still the very much hardcore Volkist elements around people like Himmler and Himmler's lieutenants in groups like the Annenerbe, which were extremely committed to this idea of German, you know, racial superiority.
That was the Ancestral Research Bureau of
the
SS.
I mean, these were the sort of the Volkists versus the pan-Europeanists. Now, the problem that the pan-Europeanists had is that really Hitler, when you came right down to it, Hitler was believed in blood ideology.
Mm-hmm.
And so Himmler and Bormann really had a free rein because Hitler endorsed these policies. So the Waffen-SS people, who were also, by the way, supported by some people inside the army, who for practical reasons saw that this point of view could only help Germany, not hurt Germany, although a minority during the war, after the war, when the sort of lessons were learned, they became much more powerful inside the sort of the post-war Nazi movement, the post-war fascist movement. And as I try to show in my book, this tension between the more Nordic elements and the more, say, Indo-European elements is very much reflected in the Northern League and in the work of Roger Pearson. And I think it's not an accident that one of the things that Roger Pearson does today is he publishes a very scholarly journal called the Journal of Indo-European Studies, about all these questions.
And we are out of time, Kevin.
Yep.
We've been talking with Kevin Coogan, author of Dreamer of the Day, Francis Parker Yaki and the Post-War Fascist International. That was published in softcover by Otano Media. You can visit their website at Otano Media, one word, AUTONOMEDIA.org. And for Kevin Coogan, this is Dave Emery saying thanks for listening to For the Record program number 312. This is being recorded on July 15th of the year 2001.